Letters on Sympathy by Sophia de Grouchy, first published in 1798. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Letter 5. The Origins of Moral Ideas.
It seems to me, my dear friend, that the preachers of virtue, Rousseau excepted, do not go back often enough to the origins of moral ideas. Yet this inquiry is the only one that can lead us to understand the scope of the intimate relation between these ideas and our conscience, between the feelings we have in following them and our happiness. Moralists have often and eloquently underscored the immediate influence of vice and virtue on our felicity. They have not been sufficiently concerned with demonstrating that the impulses to virtue and the internal pleasures it provides are a necessary consequence of our moral constitution, and that the need to be good would be an almost irresistible inclination for men who lived under wise laws and had been educated without prejudices. The feeling of having done good arises necessarily from the satisfaction we naturally feel at the sight or even the idea of others' pleasure or well-being, a pleasure for ourselves when we have brought this about for them, and an especially strong pleasure in that case, because it is savoured with more reflection, because our intention sorted out, and because it is preceded by hope, which always increases the soul's activity. If the pleasure of contributing to others' happiness is more intense than the pleasure of being a passive witness, then the pleasure we experience in alleviating the ills of others must be even more so, because it is enjoyed with even more reflection, and is always accompanied by the pleasant sensation one feels when one is freed from the idea of misery. Something else that increases the pleasure of doing good is the thought that one owes this pleasure to oneself, and that consequently one holds in one's hands the power to procure it for oneself, to reproduce it at will. We feel a natural pleasure in doing good. But another feeling also arises from this pleasure, namely the satisfaction of having done good. We take personal pleasure in the recollection of a happiness that wasn't our doing, but for this recollection to recur often in our memory, it must be linked to our existence and to our own trains of thought, and that is what happens when we are the cause of it. Then this memory integrates itself into our intimate awareness of ourselves, becomes a part of it, becomes habitual, and produces in us an agreeable sensation that lasts far longer than any clear thought of the pleasure that originally gave rise to it. So when we have clearly brought benefit to others, the pleasure we get from this is independent of the nature of the pleasure they get from it. But when we have freed them from some harm, our pleasure in this being, like theirs, a result of the cessation of pain, it is even more natural that the satisfaction of having stopped pain stays with us without our having a detailed memory of the occasion, or even any present thought about the nature of the pain we have alleviated. Thus, the pleasure of doing good forms a long-term alliance with the satisfaction of having done good, and this feeling becomes, in a way, general and abstract, since we feel it anew at the mere recollection of good actions, without recalling their particular circumstances. In my first letter, I spoke of this abstract sentiment, the most general principle of the metaphysics of the soul, just as the theory of abstract ideas is the most general principle of the metaphysics of the intellect. Also, this general feeling of having done good is the most delightful of our sensations, the one most analogous to our moral affections, the one that attracts and charms the soul, without subjecting it to the insatiable and devouring activity of the passions, the only one that can recompense humanity for all the ills it can suffer, the only one constantly at our disposal, never letting us down, always responsive, calming and filling our hearts, and an indissoluble tie between ourselves and our fellow men. Happy is he, my dear friend, who carries this sentiment unwaveringly in the depths of his heart, and who dies feeling it. He alone has lived. because the sight or idea of another's misfortune gives us a painful feeling. This feeling is more intense when we are the cause of this misfortune, even if only accidentally. If we are the cause in an absolutely involuntary manner, i.e., if we cannot attribute it to our intentions, thoughtlessness or frivolity, then the sentiment is strong only because, being more connected to our memories, it is more present in us, and we have more trouble freeing ourselves from it. If the other person's misfortune results from our thoughtlessness or frivolity, our pain will be greater, because it will join forces with the thought that we could have spared him that misfortune. This thought produces in us a very painful sentiment, through the contrast between the state our error has put us in and the state we could have been in. The thought that we could have been better makes our unease all the more sharply felt, for the same reason that one feels something bad more intensely when it follows something good. And when we vividly imagine a possible past good, we mourn it as though it had been real. To this thought is joined the fear of repeating the same mistake, an unpleasant sensation that makes one desire to avoid opportunities for it, and is the driving force behind prudence. When we have voluntarily done something bad, all of these causes come into play, and must act even more strongly, and mixed in with them is a particular pain, that of experiencing for ourselves the disagreeable feeling aroused by the sight or idea of someone who has wronged others. Just as the satisfaction of having done a good is integrated into our existence and gives us a delightful feeling, so also the awareness of having done something wrong attaches itself to our existence and disturbs it. It produces feelings of regret and remorse that afflict us, disturb us, make us suffer, and won't let us go, even when we no longer have any clear memory of the initial impression of pain that we felt because of the harm that we caused. The fear of remorse is enough to distance everyone from evil. Everyone? Yes, probably everyone has felt some remorse, at least for minor transgressions. And if there is, if there could be, someone who has never acted badly and would never do so, even he can imagine the torments of remorse, the satisfaction associated with good actions, and fear of having bad ones in one's memory, are two effective drives for shaping all our actions. Those two sentiments, that satisfaction and that fear, are universal. They are the driving force and the foundation of human morality. After learning the origin and nature of these sentiments, by applying what you have read in the preceding letters about particular sympathy, the effects of enthusiasm and the power of habit, you will easily understand, my dear friend, that these sentiments can become active and permanent, and can acquire a shaping force and even an irresistible power. Thus, for example, remorse over a bad action, or the mere fear of it, will be intensified by the idea of its staying power when the imagination depicts misfortunes spread over a whole lifetime. This capacity for remorse is one of the most deadly enemies of man's peace of mind, when, more insatiable than his heart, it makes him incapable of enjoyment, by constantly leading his thoughts and desires beyond what he possesses or beyond what he can attain. But it is also one of the most effective causes of his happiness, when it highlights for him the effects of vice and virtue, reminding him that he has, along with the power of doing good for others, the power of carrying in himself a joyful sentiment, a power that makes his happiness largely independent of chance, and with which he can both brave death and withstand all the ills of life. So, there you are, my dear friend. We already have a distinction among our actions, based solely on sentiment. It is the distinction between actions accompanied by pleasure and followed by an internal satisfaction, and actions accompanied by anguish and followed by an always disagreeable and often painful feeling. But this more lasting feeling of satisfaction or pain, connected to the memory of good or harm we have done to others, is necessarily modified by reflection. And it's the modifications brought by reflection that lead us to the idea of moral good or evil, the idea of the first and eternal rule, that judges men independently of the laws, that so few laws have consecrated or developed, that so many others have violated, and that prejudices have so often and so absurdly stifled. For example, when we give someone a pleasure that is only momentary and won't affect his life as a whole, we will have less satisfaction, unless we were motivated by a particular sympathy, than we would if the pleasure was one that would remain a long-lasting possession. We may even repent having left this person to be exposed to real dangers, in which case we will have remorse rather than satisfaction. Here, then, the difference starts to emerge between the good we do by chance and the good we do by reflection, and between the good we are drawn to by particular sympathy and the good we are directed to by general sympathy. In following a particular sympathy, we are obeying, as if by instinct, the leanings of our heart. In following a general sympathy, often undecided between the option that inclination inspires in us and a greater good that we are not so inclined to, we silently weigh which of the two actions would do the greater good to others, and we opt for the one that will give us the most lasting satisfaction, even if not the greatest immediate pleasure. From there on, our actions that were merely beneficent and humane acquire a moral goodness and beauty. From this is born the idea of virtue, that is, of actions that give others a pleasure approved by reason. The idea of the distinction between doing someone moral harm and doing someone physical harm is harder to form, but it is no less precise. When situations arise in which a slight harm to one individual prevents a greater harm to another or an equal harm to several others, then if we don't do this slight harm, we can suffer much more remorse for having failed to prevent the greater harm than we would have suffered from having committed the lesser one. Indeed, if we do the lesser harm, our regret over that will be offset by the more intense satisfaction of having prevented the more serious one. The same holds true if the hurt done to another gives us some pleasure. The pleasure will be weak, and won't compensate for the remorse attached to the damage that gave rise to it. In these various circumstances, we get the habit of consulting our reason as to what action we should take, what decision will afterwards leave us with the greatest satisfaction. In this way, we acquire the idea of moral evil, i.e., of an action harmful to another, and repudiated by our reason. This definition seems to me better than Vovnag's, according to which moral good / evil are what are useful / harmful to humanity taken as a whole. His definition is at bottom the same as mine, because the good or evil that reason approves or condemns is the same as that which is useful or harmful to humanity. But Vovnag's definition is less precise and harder to understand, because it does not match the notion that the common run of men have of moral good and evil. Indeed, one can have ordinary reason and conscience without knowing what is good or bad with respect to everyone. In defining moral concepts, it matters, more than people might think, to prefer definitions that the least enlightened of men can understand. When it is a question of discovering the general laws that govern the human heart, the most commonplace reason is the most certain and enlightened one. Once the idea of moral good and evil is acquired, and once the habit of differentiating one from the other has become familiar, we distinguish the pleasure and pain, and the satisfaction and remorse, that result from taking or abstaining from a particular action, without weighing or calculating the effects that might follow. The idea that this action is good implies a secret satisfaction, and the idea that it is bad predicts remorse, in exactly the way in which the mere idea of physical pleasure or pain produces a painful or pleasant sensation, now and for the future. This is somewhat like what happens in sciences, where the scientist uses certain methods and certain principles, relying on them for their exactness and truth, without remembering how he once proved them. Similarly, we follow general sentiments without thinking of how they were formed or of all that justifies them. So our remorse for wrongdoing, and satisfaction from doing good, can occur without running over the effects of these actions in our mind, nor do we need to have retained the general memory of having done something good, or having done something bad. All that is needed is the still more abstract and more general feeling of having acted well or acted badly. Other feelings can be combined with that one, depending on circumstances, but they don't have to enter the picture for our conscience to act in our soul, determining, judging, or rewarding/punishing our actions. When they do, though, they make a difference, often by extending rather than weakening the reach of conscience. For example, our remorse for acting badly or satisfaction for acting well is increased if the signs of pain or pleasure arising from our actions are more expressive, more affecting, more capable of etching themselves into our imagination and speaking through it to our conscience. Souls that are easily moved are more often guided by these particular factors, signs of grief or joy, etc. Those whose sensibility is deeper and more thoughtful usually comply with the more abstract and more general sentiments that go with good or evil. When the former do good, they act with less self-restraint. The latter act in a more orderly fashion and with a more refined justice. The former get a more intense pleasure from this, whereas the pleasure of the latter owes more to reason, though usually amour propre also comes into it. The former are apt to make their minds up in advance and refuse to face facts. The latter are apt to miss the good, through insisting on looking for the best. It is to be hoped that easily moved souls are common among the vast number of people, who have only superiors and equals, and that the more orderly souls are common among the class of men who command and govern. Another way of distinguishing some hearts and minds from others concerns how easily they come to experience an abstract and general sentiment, that is, one that is simply an awareness of what is common to several individual sentiments, akin to how easy they find it to have abstract and general ideas. Hearts capable of these sentiments are the only genuinely upright ones, because only they can be guided by unwavering principles. They are the only ones whose sensibility can be relied on, because general considerations are always there to stimulate it effectively. Conscience is not easily silenced in them. Remorse is thus more dependable and effective in them, and their ideas of their obligations are more complete. They, above all, are the ones who know how to perform those duties demanding delicacy and honesty that morality alone imposes and recognizes, the forgetting of which brings only regret and the loss of joy, and in which one finds the disinterested virtues that can only be produced by the need to have the highest and most satisfying ideas possible about oneself. Egoism, no doubt produced by forgetting these abstract and general sentiments, or by an inability to experience them, then extinguishes them. The shameful and base habit of considering everything in relation to oneself, and of judging essentially from this point of view, really does gradually weaken the feelings attached to good and evil. When people regard egoism as less dangerous and less blameworthy than the apparently more harmful passions, such as hatred, vengeance, even envy, they are letting it off too lightly. Those other passions are almost always short-lived. They are rare, and each instance of them is ruinous to only a very small number of men, whereas egoism infects and torments entire classes. Excesses of the passions in question are nearly always suppressed by the law, whereas egoism has so far been only lightly condemned and weakly punished by morality and public opinion. Finally, it is true that these passions sometimes lead to violent actions, but when egoism does not do so, it is nearly always because such actions would bring harm to the egoist. There is hardly a secret injustice or cruelty of which egoism is not capable. If other passions can make someone more dangerous, egoism makes him more corrupt, because it leaves him with no push towards virtue except his amour propre, and no restraint except human respect, a flimsy barrier that manipulative skill abolishes at will. Minds lacking strength or scope to arrive at abstract and general ideas, so as to receive and combine all their components, can never achieve substantial results. Nor, therefore, can they enlarge the sphere of important truths in any domain, or, in some cases, even grasp truths that are the upshot of calculation and broadly based comparisons. So you would try in vain to get views that grow out of these ideas, adopted by someone who cannot even grasp the ideas. Solely concerned with humdrum and isolated issues, and with particular and local views, he will label as dangerous any system that he can't understand. Taking pride in his false discretion, he will disdainfully wrap himself up in his errors. The greater or lesser ability to have abstract and general ideas is a kind of scale on which to place all minds, in order to know their level and what they can relate to. Those who have acquired the habit of adding to and generalizing their ideas are never stopped from advancing. Those in whom the need to extend the number and reach of their ideas has been foiled or stifled by other passions, and that is most people, usually remain at a certain level, and never switch thoughts, so to speak. That is why it is so hard to enlighten men, even regarding their real interests. One must first look into their passions, to find forces that will extend and renew their intelligence, which has been weakened by inaction or degraded by error, and then get them to accept the truth, either by presenting it to them, under clever or brilliant guises that prove seductive, or by gently captivating reason through a logic so compelling that the last step leading to the conclusion is no harder to take than the first. One of the primary goals of education should thus be to provide the ability to acquire general ideas, and to experience these abstract and general feelings I have spoken to you about, and ordinary education usually distances itself from this goal. The study of grammar comes first, and, if children understand it, that admittedly gives them a start on having a few metaphysical ideas. But some of these are the most mistaken, or at least the most incoherent. Children learn languages through the drill of applying rules to translate authors, whose thoughts they often cannot understand. They are nearly always presented with history, cleansed of the sweeping results that alone make history useful, because those results would make it too easy for them to grasp the abuses the powers that be want them to respect. They are brought up amid prejudices of pride and vanity that deprive them of a sense of the inalienable rights all men have, their right to genuine happiness and to their genuine worth, in order to instill in them instead the idea of counterfeit pleasures and social hierarchies, the respect and desire for which shrivel the mind, corrupt reason, and snuff out conscience. The morality they are taught almost always consists of a jumble of separate precepts, in which the most minor duties are mixed with the most sacred ones, all announced in the same way, and with the same air of importance. Rarely does this morality lead them to look into their own hearts for the eternal and general laws that decide between good and evil, to find there the sentiments that reward the one and punish the other. The study of the sciences is nearly always rejected at the moment when the mind, already accustomed to settling for vague ideas and attending to words rather than things, has trouble following their methodical, reasoned path, gets tired even when they are nothing but a sequence of obvious truths, and has to struggle to grasp their general principles, or cannot do anything with them intellectually. So let us, my dear friend, stop reproaching nature for being miserly with its supply of great men. Stop being surprised that the general laws of nature are still so little known. How many times in a century does education succeed in giving minds the strength and rigour needed to form abstract ideas? How often has it perfected the mind's instinct for truth? How often has it strengthened the truth through its tendency to follow it alone and to be ceaselessly nourished by it? On the other side, how often education leads us astray into the byways of routine and convention, from prejudice to prejudice and from error to error? How often it has taken our need to live exclusively through the useful, true, and wide-ranging activities to which nature calls our minds and hearts, and transformed it into a need to live only for the deceptive and narrow-minded pleasures of amour propre and vanity. Oh, what pools of virtue, talent, and enlightenment this single error has eliminated, and still eliminates, from the human species!
End of letter 5.